What is life, mind and matter?
My name is John Atkins. I'm a research professor in the biochemistry department in UCC, and I study non-standard readout of hereditary information.
I'm David McConnell, professor of genetics at Trinity College in the Smurfit Institute of Genetics. And broadly speaking, I have studied the way in which genes are regulated.
It was thought that the hereditary information was likely proteins because they would have sufficient complexity to do it until 1944, when Avery and colleagues found, Avery, McLeod and McCarthy, found that the hereditary information was DNA.
RNA is ribonucleic acid, DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, and the difference between them is one oxygen atom in a particular place. And also one other change, which is relatively minor. So they're very similar chemicals. However, DNA is actually very stable chemically. RNA is, relatively speaking, unstable. And so the two, that's a very important quality, which in a way fits DNA to be, in most cases, the genetic material, and RNA to be involved in regulating the genetic material.
It was Watson and Crick who in 1953 in Cambridge proposed a model for the structure of DNA, which we now know to be the correct one. It's a double helix, yes, with an outer double helical structure, the two strands going in opposite directions, with bases projecting in the middle, and there were two sets. So if you had A on one side, you always had T on the other side, to use an abbreviation of the full word, and C versus a G, for instance.
They are chemical units, and there are four different kinds. If you imagine a ladder, and you have actually got four different kinds of steps in the ladder. And now you can imagine a ladder which is 3 billion steps long. That's what the human DNA essentially looks like. But the order of those steps is the genetic information. So as a result of Watson and Crick, we could see that the genetic information was encoded in these chemicals.
And so once you had the order in one strand, then the order of the newly formed strand would be specified based on the previous strand. But in a human, for instance, it's only a small proportion of the sequence in the DNA that specifies the proteins which carry out nearly all the reactions within cells. It's only a few percent, actually, that directly specify proteins. And a substantial amount of the rest specifies a related molecule called RNA. And that has a variety of roles, regulatory roles and other functions, some of which are only recently being discovered.
I think it's interesting really to say here a little bit about what John himself has been working on over all these years. In fact, he has been one of the central figures in studying the role of RNA. We now know as a result of extraordinary work, partly by John and by many other people around the world, that RNA plays a very, very much bigger role in biological systems than was anticipated in 1953. In fact, in 1953, everything was really focused on DNA.
So RNA is more versatile, although indeed it is less stable. It is more versatile and it forms an enormous variety of different shapes, which in turn affect its ability to function in many different ways. The original usage of RNA was thought to be just to make a copy of the information, the DNA, and that there were small RNAs then called transfer RNAs, which were involved in readout of the information. So the initial, until relatively recently, thought of the prime role of RNA, apart from the hereditary material of a few viruses, was in fact in the readout of the information in DNA. And it is now known that RNA itself can regulate the expression of DNA and modulate the readout process in ways that were completely unanticipated until the last 10 years or so. And there's an increasing number of variety of RNAs being found, even as recently as a month ago, where there were circular RNAs that was found. It's the most recent type, but there are undoubtedly others. And the functions of many of these recently discovered types is yet unknown or only partially known.
So as you've can understand, 1953, the discovery of DNA, 2013, 60 years. So we're celebrating 60 years of DNA and everything that has come from the discovery of the structure of DNA. John Atkins and I, we thought it would be a good idea to celebrate this in a way that the public could take advantage of. So we decided to commission a sculpture by quite a famous, internationally known American sculptor, Charles Jenks. The wonderful thing about this sculpture is it will not only show DNA in an 18-foot sculpture in aluminium, but it would also show or illustrate to some extent the enormous increase in greater understanding we have of the role of RNA. And this sculpture is going to be unveiled in the National Botanic Gardens. It will be unveiled by James D. Watson of Watson and Crick. It's wonderful that he's willing to come and willing to celebrate with us 60 years of his great discovery. And of course, he's participating in discoveries in celebrations all around the world. But he's coming to us.
The hereditary material of all known organisms on Earth is DNA, apart from some viruses which are not functional organisms as such and are dependent upon organisms for which DNA is the hereditary material. So one new, relatively new use of DNA, in a sense, is for forensics, for determining the identity of people from small samples. There's a very sensitive amplification procedure. And so from really minute samples, you're able to get specific information which can be used for tracing purposes, the identity of the person who left a sample behind, or for the relationship between peoples. And in a broader sense, determining the relationship between people is important for genealogy, but also in terms of the origin of peoples and how they've moved throughout the world during the course of human migrations in different parts of the world and colonized different parts of the world can be traced very effectively from DNA sequence analysis. But also, in fact, not just the relationship between different humans, it's the relationship between different organisms on Earth. And so we can have a tree of life, as it were, and we can trace the connectiveness of related species and the origin of them.
This whole story of evolution, of course, we know that it was Darwin who first put it on a solid basis in the middle of the 19th century, and subsequently the botanists and zoologists and paleontologists produced evidence for the relationship of different kinds of organisms. But once we knew about DNA, it became possible to only analyze the DNA of all creatures on the planet, and you can compare these DNAs and you can show which organisms are most closely related to each other. So, for example, it's not too surprising that chimpanzees are our closest relative. And, by the way, the next is the gorilla, and after that it's the orangutan, and then there's the gibbons and so on. So you can build up a family tree, but you can build up a family tree for everything. And you can show that every organism on the planet is related to every other organism. That means we're related to the HIV virus. You know, anything, it doesn't matter, grass. A redwood tree, those are our relatives. And all that comes out of the DNA. You don't even need to look at the tree to know that actually it's a relative of ours because you can analyze the DNA. And that's truly astonishing. We can also put dates on when we had, for the sake of the argument, a common relative with the chimpanzee. It turns out to be 7 million years ago. You can also put a date on when all modern humans had a common ancestor, and that's about 200,000 years ago. All that comes out of Watson and Crickery of 1953. So modern DNA technology, sometimes people call it GM or genetic engineering. The technical name amongst geneticists is recombinant DNA. That technology emerged in the 1970s. And from the early 1970s on, it was clear we were going to be able to isolate individual genes and move them from one organism to another. And by the end of the 1970s, it was shown that we could do this in plants. So we could take a gene from one organism and put it into a plant. I'll give you one example. There's a bacterial gene which causes insects to die. They took that gene from a bacterium and they put it into plants. And the plants then produce the toxin, which was otherwise produced by the bacterium. And when an insect eats the plant leaf, it dies. And now many, many varieties of plants around the world have been given that gene, including, say, cotton, soy, rapeseed, and so on. And the result is we have crops which are more resistant to insects than they were previously. Now, of course, as I've said, I understand really very well that many people are anxious about GM and oppose it very strongly, and in Europe perhaps more than elsewhere. But the simple fact of the matter is that this is a scientific technology which emerged from 1953, the discovery of the DNA double helix. And it has opened huge horizons within plant breeding. I've given a specific example, but in fact, conventional plant breeding is now being greatly accelerated by the use of DNA techniques to analyze the progeny of what are called hybrid crosses. So one way or another, the genetics is having a radical effect on the efficiency of plant breeding worldwide. It is quite interesting in the context of this play that the idea of pre-implantation diagnosis could not have taken place had not Steptoe and Edwards first worked on the early embryology of the human embryo, indeed worked with IVF and developed methods for growing the very early embryo in culture and then transplanting it into the mother. If you couldn't work with human embryos outside the womb, first of all, then you couldn't do the pre-implantation. It's obvious from the name, pre-implantation. Couldn't do the pre-implantation diagnosis. And, of course, it's rather sad to record the recent death of Edwards. Well, pre-implantation diagnosis is a method by which you can, scientists, doctors, medical scientists, can take a tiny piece from a very early embryo, even as little as one cell, preferably a few more, and can tell whether the embryo has a serious genetic disorder or will or the child would have a serious genetic disorder or not. And it's of very great importance to families, pre-implantation, in other words, broadly speaking, what people might imagine as a test tube baby or a tiny IVF, produced by IVF, and can tell whether that embryo is going to develop a serious genetic disorder or not. So this is extremely important for families which are unfortunate enough that they maybe have had a child already with a very serious genetic disorder and would like to try to ensure that they will not have another one with that genetic disorder. For example, muscular dystrophy would be one case, or there's a really horrible disorder which affects you in middle age or later called Huntington's chorea. Huntington's chorea, the word chorea comes from the word dance, the Greek for dance. And people who get Huntington's in their middle age, late middle age, they begin to find that they move uncontrollably. And there is almost no way that I don't know that doctors are able, in fact, to control their movements. And eventually they essentially, certainly in the old days, they would have to be essentially strapped into chairs or strapped into bed. And eventually they die. And certainly until very recently, there were no really helpful treatments for this. Maybe today there are some things that can ameliorate it, but it's a horrible thing. Fortunately, it's very rare. But if it's in the family, as it were, and that's a very hard thing to have to live with because you will have seen either your mother or your father contract it. And you as a youngish person might not know if you're going to contract it, although you can be tested to find out. But you can find out if the embryos that you conceive are going to develop that or not. There are certain kinds of breast cancer caused by mutations in genes. And these can be avoided by using the method of pre-implantation diagnosis. It is quite interesting in the context of this play that the idea of pre-implantation diagnosis could not have taken place had not Steptoe and Edwards first worked on the early embryology of the human embryo, indeed worked with IVF and developed methods for growing the very early embryo in culture and then transplanting it into the mother. If you couldn't work with human embryos outside the womb, first of all, then you couldn't do the pre-implantation. It's obvious from the name, pre-implantation. Couldn't do the pre-implantation diagnosis. And, of course, it's rather sad to record the recent death of Edwards.
When I got my PhD in 1970, the thought of being able to clone the human gene for insulin and to put it into yeast so that you could express human insulin cheaply and efficiently in yeast to be able to give it to diabetics rather than using pig insulin, no one had any clue when that would be possible. Maybe in 1,000 years, 10,000 years or 50 years, no one knew. What happened was really quite dramatic. It was found that there was molecular scissors, if you like, specific ones that had been evolved in bacteria as part of a defense system, in fact, which could be used to cut DNA. And then there was another simple product of evolution, a protein. They could join the fragments of DNA together and you could clone DNA. So this happened in the early 1970s, and within a very, very short number of years, the human gene for insulin had been cloned, and it had been produced in yeast, and this took over from the supply of pig insulin. And so there have been other things. Enbrel is one, which was produced in Ireland, and there have been a variety of other things which are derived in that way. One other thing that sprung in this way was the ability to sequence DNA to determine the order of building blocks in DNA. And this is used for diagnosis. So the sequence of many different types of bacteria is determined, and it's quickly can identify the causative organisms, because bacteria, while they have some different characteristics, they look rather similar. And being able to quickly determine the order of the building blocks in them can identify them and help in diagnosis. But also the same is true for viruses. This is true for herpes viruses and many other ones, that being able to know what you're dealing with is important for how to treat it. But it's also provided an enormous amount of basic information about the structure of viruses and, for instance, suggests ways to get antiviral therapies and to control them. But the use of DNA is much more prevalent than that. For instance, in disease states and different forms of cancer, there's sequencing going on, trying to determine the cause of them, as indeed with many other diseases.
You may test for the presence of between 50 and 100 so-called cancer genes. That's a shorthand for saying genes which are mutated in cancers, allowing the pathologists and the physicians to distinguish between one kind of cancer and another with much greater accuracy, and therefore prescribe more appropriate therapies. Astonishing stuff. It's interesting to reflect on the importance of our understanding of DNA in some recent medical decisions, policy decisions in Ireland. For example, the decision to make the vaccine against human papillomavirus, this is the virus that causes cervical cancer, to make that vaccination program available in Ireland. I had lunch the other day with Zurhausen, the man who did all the basic work on this. And I can tell you, it's absolutely plain. There's no way in which we would have been able to develop those vaccines, which are going to save thousands, millions of lives, I expect, without the DNA technology and the understanding of the structure of DNA. We would have been totally unable to analyze as quickly as we did the nature of HIV. People knew about AIDS, but they didn't know what was causing it. But it was through extraordinarily clever DNA and RNA work, because the HIV virus is an RNA virus, to analyze that virus, define it, and also specifically to develop what people know is called the triple therapy. This is the therapy which is used. All that came out of DNA work. Well, Montagnier was the French scientist who made very important contributions, but there were a very large number of other people. And I should say they're much maligned. The pharmaceutical companies are much maligned. But in fact, their response to the HIV story was extraordinary. And within a very short time, they had developed various therapies, and new therapies are being developed all the time, including, by the way, just to refer again, new diagnostic methods. The fact is that with modern techniques, we should be able to diagnose bacterial infections much, much faster. And those methods are based on DNA. One of the most dramatic effects of DNA technology, understanding the structure of DNA, being able to analyze that structure, is, of course, in forensic genetics, forensic DNA work, what people commonly call DNA fingerprinting. I know that the forensic scientists regard that as the greatest innovation in forensic science since the original fingerprints were introduced, which was just pre-1900, if I remember correctly. And it has absolutely changed the way in which forensic science is done. I think people are now pretty well familiar that each of us has a completely unique genetic fingerprint. That is, except in the case of identical twins. And with tiny amounts of material, even, for example, if I cough, I've stolen a car and I cough, the windscreen will have little tiny pieces of my cough, and you can take from that enough DNA to get my DNA fingerprint and identify me. And of course, if you ally that to DNA databases, and I have to say I'm so sorry that in Ireland we have been so slow in establishing an effective forensic DNA database, but these DNA databases then allow the forensic scientists to establish what are called hits or no hits and to identify people with extraordinary accuracy. It seems to me to be quite rather strange that there hasn't been a greater acceptance of the idea of DNA fingerprinting, especially, I should say, by women who, after all, suffer from the most horrible things. I mean, criminal acts which men are usually the perpetrators of. And those cases could be much, much more rapidly solved if there were much larger DNA databases. Now, there are obviously very important legal issues here, but They're not insuperable.
Well, it's true with many technologies or many changes that it can be used for good or for bad. It's a societal decision as to how to use any particular technology. But what we are finding out is a large amount of how things work, and there's possibilities for intervention in many ways. I mean, one of the bad things you could imagine out of some of the biology work is some sort of bioterrorism thing using some of the newer techniques. And you can imagine other things as well. But society has had decisions to make. But we are understanding where we come from and what we can do and how to ameliorate all sorts of problems. Well, Jim Watson's quote about DNA is the only one who was hurt by DNA analysis was Bill Clinton. Actually, no, it was making fun, of course. It was actually in India he did this. Well, people are asked him, oh, but it's so dangerous what you're finding out, what it can be used for. Well, the only one who's been hurt so far, was the reply. In fact, it's Bill Clinton, because he, for obvious reasons,
was addressed. This is Jim Watson replying.
This is Jim Watson replying to a question, because of the dress, of course. So
I think one of the most interesting things about DNA is, from an Irish perspective, is the fact that Irish scientists or scientists in Ireland made some very significant contributions. So I'll mention J.D. Bernal, who was born in Tipperary, who became in the 1920s, 1930s into the 40s, one of the leading scientists in the field of X-ray crystallography. Now, that's the field that led partly to played a very important role in getting the structure of DNA. And a second person who made an important contribution was Maurice Wilkins, whose mother and father were Irish. They left Ireland in the early 1900s to go to New Zealand. He was a Trinity-educated doctor. Maurice was born in New Zealand. They came back to Ireland in the very early 1920s, intending to settle here. But there were better opportunities for his father in London, so they went to London. Maurice was educated and brought up in England. And he's the third man of the double helix. And he received a Nobel Prize with Watson and Crick for the discovery of the double helix. So Irish genes in Wilkins, no question about it. And then another person who should be mentioned is Erwin Schrödinger. Not Irish, of course, but came here at De Valera's invitation to set up the School of Theoretical Physics in the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, and wrote a really influential book, What is Life?, published in 1944 during the war from Dublin. It influenced Watson, Crick, and Wilkins to decide that they would study the genetic material, which by the time they came to it was known to be DNA. So Schrödinger wrote this really influential book. Great physicist, you see, Nobel Prize winner. People paid attention to what Schrödinger wrote, even though it's rather puzzling when you read it and you wonder what actually he's saying, but it influenced physicists. So there were very significant contributions from Ireland or by Irish people, people connected with Ireland, in the stages that led to the discovery of the double helix. And since not all that many people in Ireland realise how many contributions we have actually made from this country to science.
Lest we become too smug, however, some concern that the in the current Irish schools curriculum, that the imbalance between the amount of emphasis on molecular biology, on DNA and RNA, compared to the macrobiology, is not the right one. And so to try and stimulate some interest, we introduced a prize for the best essay or poem, either in the post-primary schools anywhere throughout the island of Ireland, or for primary schools in a restricted geographical area, which coincidentally happens to be West Cork and South Kerry. Jim Watson will present the prize to the winners, if they choose to have it presented in person, at the opening of the sculpture.
Well, we do hope that this sculpture in the National Botanic Gardens will encourage everybody who sees it, especially young people, to ask questions about the natural world around them and to become interested in trying to explain, understand the natural world, and to participate in the great enterprise of science, which is, after all, one of the greatest of the universal human activities. Pop music, soccer and science, those are the three things which go all around the globe. Yeah? Everything else is restricted in one way or another. But science is truly international, and it is wonderful and exciting. Now, it's difficult, and in order to encourage people, young people, to become interested in science and to put the work in, we need first of all, we need great support for our science teachers. If you don't have dedicated and wonderfully supported science teachers, you can't actually developed the interest in many of the children at any rate. So we have to give them something special, recognise that they need recognition of a kind, because it's hard. How do you persuade a very good scientist to become a science teacher? That's a big question, because there are so many other opportunities. So we need to make science teaching very, very attractive. Laboratories have got to be constructed. They've got to be supported. They've got to be funded. And I would say very, very strongly, and I'm a biologist and so is John, that the three fundamental subjects are mathematics, physics and chemistry. And we've got to identify the really bright young kids and challenge them like crazy and encourage them, stimulate them to take an interest in these fundamental subjects. And we're not doing it as strongly as we should. And if we need to find models, well, we probably need to go to South Korea, Singapore, some of the Far Eastern countries where they've discovered ways really of turning on the young. We should also learn about how the Russians did it. We should ask some of our colleagues who are now in Ireland but from Russia how it was that they were educated to become such outstanding mathematicians, like Igor Shvets, for example, in Trinity. He talks a lot about it. What happened in Russia, I learned from Igor Shvets in Trinity, was that they would identify the kids who had natural mathematical ability when they were very young, a bit the same way as in Kilkenny they'd identify the hurlers. And they'd have them out on the banks of the Slaney there, as I saw them many times. These little kids, hardly big enough to hold a hurley, being taught hurling. In Russia, they did that for mathematics. In Ireland, we're used to doing it also for children who have musical ability. We can spot them when they're very young, and mums and dads will go to the ends of the earth to get them extra music lessons and so on and so forth. Do you know of parents who do that if they discover that their kid has a natural inclination in mathematics? You don't, you see? So we really do have to recognise that these are very, very special talents, and we've got to find those kids when they're young and not make it a drudgery or anything like that, because it isn't. When you're really naturally good at it, if you're, for example, a chess prodigy, or you're just half good at chess when you're a kid, it can be made to be such fun. So that's the way we've got to treat it and recognise that this is of national importance. You know, we're not actually educating people in our schools to a good level in mathematics by comparison, for example, to the French or the Germans or whatever. We're simply not doing it, no matter what these international comparisons are. I can tell you, I see these students when they come into Trinity. Their mathematical training is not sound enough.